Welcome to The Wicket.
Hello and welcome to the latest slice of Cricket in Conversation from Arab News. I'm Brian Murgatroyd, and with me as ever to assess the latest happenings in the sport are Arab News columnist John Pike and Arab News cricket reporter Subhash Hamagain. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Subhash.
Hello, Brian. Hello, John.
And in this episode, we reflect on a thrilling finish to the Pakistan Super League. We look back at the Women's Premier League, the second edition of which has wrapped up in India. We chat about the start of the England Women's Tour of New Zealand, with both sides missing key players because of that Women's Premier League. We look back at a series win for Bangladesh's men against Sri Lanka in the ODI format. We discuss the Afghanistan Island men's 2020 international series in Sharjah. We chat about the cricket tournament that forms part of the African Games in Accra, Ghana, that, despite its lack of column inches around the world, holds major significance for the 2026 Men's T20 World Cup. And Subhash and John give us their personal highlights from the past week. That's all to come. But if you want our views on the Indian Premier League, the IPL, then check your podcast feed, as we've recorded an episode of The Wicket dedicated to the tournament, where John and Subhash run the rule over all the sides in turn and then pick the franchises they expect to be challenging for the title and the players to look out for. But there's still plenty of subjects to discuss away from the IPL, and that's exactly what we're going to do now. Islamabad United became the first side to win the Pakistan Super League three times when they defeated Multan Sultans by two wickets off the last ball in a thrilling final. Islamabad did it the hard way too, having to win three games in a row after scraping into the playoffs. They overcame Quetta Gladiators, Peshawar Zalmi and then Multan Sultans in the final. The hero was Imad Wasim, the seemingly forgotten man of Pakistan cricket, who's not forgotten anymore after four incredible contributions. Against Multan, in a must-win game to get into the playoffs, he made 30 not out from 13 balls as Islamabad chased down 229. In qualifier one against Quetta, he took 3 for 12 with his left-arm spin. Against Peshawar in qualifier two, he scored an unbeaten 59 from 40 balls in another run chase. And then in the final, he took 5 for 23 and then scored 19 not out from 17 balls to help his side over the line. He was player of the match in each of those last three matches. For Multan, it was heartbreak, as it was their third final loss in a row, and this defeat followed on from back-to-back reverses against Lahore Qalandars in both 2022 and 2023. The loss was especially tough on Usman Khan of Multan, who in seven innings produced scores of 14, 96, 106 not out, 100 not out, 21, 36 not out and 57 in the final, for a total of 430 runs, but he still ended up on the losing side. Incidentally, he's been qualifying for the UAE and is classed as an overseas player now in Pakistan. To the victor, though, goes the glory, and Islamabad captain Shadab Khan, so recently struggling in the ILT20 as he came back from injury, he was named player of the series for 305 runs and 14 wickets. John, we spoke at the outset of the PSL about its struggles for relevance in the face of competing competitions. Has this finale and nine last ball finishes given it the lift it may be needed?
It helps, but I don't think it's enough. A few of the big players now join the PSL. It's slipped behind SA20 and ILT20 on several metrics. And this year it clashed with national elections, which took people's and media attention away. It clashed with Ramadan and will do so for the next 5 years, whilst leadership instability at the PCB creates uncertainty. It really is between a rock and a hard place.
Subhash, what can you say of Islamabad and Imad Wazim in particular? It was real backs to the wall stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think what was expected of them throughout this series, but they couldn't get that firing. But come knockouts, I think they had pretty much the resources came to use. And Imad Wasim in particular, I think he was a forgotten man with the ball, with the bat. I think with the bat, he was pretty much silent until that second last game and the final. I think he made himself known to this crowd. And now that with this performance, he's among the talks about coming back into the World Cup. And not just Imad Wasim, I think there were talks about Nasim Musa and his brothers coming in. But I think the last ball, all the fans who doubted his brother would have counted him to get that runs.
And John, Multan was the form side for so long in this tournament, but again, they've come away with nothing. Can they take any consolation from this agonizing loss and their efforts as a whole?
Rizwan took it very well publicly, but it must hurt very deeply, I would have thought. And I wonder how the former England World Cup winning Alex Hartley, who was spin coach from Multan, alongside ex-Ireland international Kath Dalton, became the first woman to be a fast bowling coach in a professional men's team, felt about it all. I think it's also a disappointment for Peshawar Zalmi, who finished second overall, but didn't make it to the final.
Subhash, you've mentioned Imad Wasim already. Were there any other players who caught your eye in particular? And do you think anyone can come into the T20 squad for the World Cup off the back of performances here in the PSL?
I think Usama Mir has done pretty much everything he could to get that World Cup spot, but the role for the second spinner, I think Imad Wasim has come into the framework. Abrar Ahmed was outstanding throughout the leagues, and he might fight for the spot with Imad Wasim. Sadaf Khan, I think, is out of this talk now with Imad Wasim performing that way. So I'd like to see one of Abrar or Imad in that position.
One other news line out of Pakistan over the past week, and following on from something we discussed in the previous episode, former Australia all-rounder Shane Watson, who coached Quetta in the PSL, has reportedly stepped back from the prospect of being the new Pakistan head coach after suggestions in the media that he was sounded out about the role. It means that Pakistan are still without a permanent person for that position, with the men's T20 World Cup just 3 months away. Royal Challengers Bangalore has won the Women's Premier League in India, comfortably beating Delhi Capitals in the final by 8 wickets after earlier overcoming Mumbai Indians in the eliminator. It was a surprise result given Delhi and Mumbai, the top two sides in the group stage, looked on course to repeat last year's inaugural final, but it was a fully deserved success. First of all, in that eliminator, Mumbai lost their way at the end when, needing 16 from the last 13 balls with 7 wickets in hand, India captain Harmanpreet Kaur was dismissed and they went on to lose by 5 runs. Then, in the final, left-arm spinner Sophie Molyneux, recently restored to the Australia side after a long-term injury absence, took 3 for 20 as Delhi fell apart, having reached 64 without loss in the 8th over to be all out for just 113. It was a target that RCB knocked off with ease as Elise Perry made 35 not out to cap a super tournament for herself and RCB. Subhash, did you see this result coming?
The way Perry performed, I think the tournament was made for her to win. Without her, I think RCB would never be close. And Delhi, I think they faltered right at the end. They were impressive throughout the tournament, but 113 in the final is never a score good enough to defend. And Perry made sure that the RCB are comfortably through. And I think this underlines the benchmark that Perry is going to set for not just being a cricketer, but what an athlete she is. She's won everything that possibly an athlete could, and what a way to end the WPL for RCB as well.
John, a word on Sophie Molyneux. The last few months she's had, well, they've been terrific, haven't they? They must seem like due reward for all the months on the sidelines that she's had. Even as recently as the start of the season, she was still on the comeback trail following an anterior cruciate ligament injury. And now here she is, back in the national side and a WPL winner.
Yes, we mentioned her return in previous podcast. It's a truly amazing comeback. I have to say that the shots played against her in the 3 wickets and four balls weren't very good. Maybe we should give her the benefit of the doubt and say she outthought the batters. Add to that, her fielding and run out of Radha Yadav was top notch. I think also I mentioned should go to Elise Perry. You also mentioned her, but a supreme athlete. And she turned RCB's fortunes prior to the final with an outstanding all-round display of mastery, a league best 6 for 15 and 40 not out against reigning champions Mumbai to get Bangalore to the eliminator, in which she starred again.
Yes, outstanding stuff from Elise Perry and Sophie Molyneux as well, and they both deserve their winners' medal. There's no question about that. Subhash, RCB men's team has famously never won the IPL. Apparently, Virat Kohli video called the women's team to offer his congratulations. Can we see this victory as an omen to help the men finally get the tag of chokers off their backs?
Well, if not now, when is the question? They've got all the resources. Virat Kohli is towards the twilight of his career, and this couldn't be better than ever. I think Kohli needs to get the spot for the World Cup squad. There's been talks he'll be in, he'll not be in. I think this is a moment where Virat Kohli needs to be Virat Kohli that we have seen. I think a couple of years back, we were doubting him whether his career is gonna be in. But in the World Cup, we saw what Virat Kohli is. So I think it's a perfectly set up for Virat Kohli and his company to make this happen. And I really hope he does this.
John, so a second edition of the tournament is done and dusted. How would you class it? A success? And if so, why? Surely it's only going to get bigger, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What is success in this arena? I think it's certainly caught India's attention, especially the women. But I think it's also raising the standard of women's cricket. And I think probably the best answer to this was given by Elise Perry, who said, "This is a whole new world, another level for us in women's cricket. The standard of cricket has been unbelievable, and it's been so much fun to play."
England's women are in New Zealand for a white ball tour featuring five 2020 internationals and three one-day internationals, and the tour has started with both sides experiencing something men's cricket is already used to. Alice Capsey, Sophie Eccleston, Danny Wyatt, and Nat Siverbrunt were all unavailable for England at the start of the tour because of their Women's Premier League commitments in India. Amelia Kerr and Sophie Devine, the New Zealand white ball captain, also missed the first 2020 international on Tuesday, March the 19th, for the same reason. While John Lewis, the England head coach, who held the same role with the UP Warriors in the Women's Premier League, was only able to be in New Zealand as his side was knocked out at the end of the group stage. England captain Heather Knight and seam bowler Lauren Bell pulled out of their WPL deals to concentrate on the tour. The clash came about due to the late announcement of dates by the BCCI, the Board of Control for Cricket in India, with the New Zealand-England series in the diaries, in John Lewis's words, for a very long time. That first match in Dunedin on Tuesday, the 19th of March, saw Knight star for England as they beat New Zealand by 27 runs. She scored 63 from 39 deliveries as England made 160 for four, and Susie Bates, 65 in 51 balls in response, wasn't enough to get New Zealand to victory. Interestingly, with those WPL absentees, Tammy Beaumont, a standout player in Test and One Day action in 2023, got another opportunity at the top of the order, while Georgia Plimmer, one of New Zealand's replacement players, scored 21. John, as the women's game grows, can you foresee more of these sorts of clashes coming up, or is there a way around them?
I think it's inevitable, especially if the BCCI continues its domineering approach, which is likely as Indian women's cricket grows. I think there's only one direction of travel. I give a salute to Heather Knight and Lauren Bell for representing the country.
Subhash, one thing is for sure, it gives an opportunity for both teams to test the players just below their first choice lineups, doesn't it? But it was alarming to hear Sophie Devine in the run-up to the series say there wasn't much depth coming through in New Zealand cricket. What did you make of that?
I think in a way she was right. If you look at the game, I think Susie Bates was one positive factor in that run chase, and New Zealand didn't get going with the new players who got the chance without their mainstays. So I think this was an opportunity for new players to sign, maybe have some more game time in the matches. But sadly, they didn't perform, and her divine statement proved right.
John Heather-Knight said she has no regrets about prioritising England duty over the WPL, but Nat Siver-Brunt admitted her decision to stay in the league was influenced by money. Can you blame either player for making the decisions they made?
Well, I think a double salute to Heather taking her captaincy duties seriously. But Nat needs the money. I don't know the circumstances. So I think any further comment is appropriate.
Subhash, how important are these matches ahead of the Women's T20 World Cup later this year? And can we read too much into them, given the comings and goings of players and the fact they're happening in a country with conditions totally different to the ones that exist in Bangladesh, where that T20 World Cup will take place?
Well, if you see, they should have match practice regularly, despite not having the same conditions. But the players who played in the WPL will have some advantage of getting to know the subcontinent conditions. I think most of the players would have never played in India or Bangladesh because there's less women cricket anyways. So I think the WPL has a little bit of advantage side on that point. But the players, those who don't get to play the WPL, I think they should be match ready and getting to know the match pressure conditions because you don't get to have top-notch women's cricket anyways. So I think the conditions aside, I think this is a good preparation for the World Cup.
As the tour continues, we will, of course, follow all the action here at the wicket. And the same goes for the Australia tour of Bangladesh, which involves three one-day internationals that are part of the Women's Championship, the qualifier for the ICC Women's World Cup, and three 2020 internationals. We'll update you on both those series in our next episode. The Sri Lanka men's tour of Bangladesh has seen the hosts win a three-match one-day international series 2-1, offering them a measure of revenge for the same scoreline in favour of Sri Lanka in the T20I series that preceded it. In the three one-day internationals, all in Chattogram, they were won by the side batting second. The deciding match was won by Bangladesh by 4 wickets with almost 10 overs to spare, as Tanzid Hassan, who came into the team as a concussion substitute in place of Shumya Sharkar after the latter collided with a boundary board in the penultimate over of the Sri Lanka innings, scored 84, while Rizad Hossain powered 48 not out from just 18 deliveries to help his side over the line. The third match was remarkable, actually, as Mushfiqur Rahim took a blow to the hand from a Mustafizur Rahman delivery. Mustafizur was actually stretchered off with cramp. Jaker Ali and Aminul Haque collided in the field, going for a high catch. And umpire Richard Kettleborough was replaced as one of the on-field umpires by local official Tanvir Ahmed after he was unwell because of the extreme heat. Subhash, that's a great win for Bangladesh, isn't it? Especially after the disappointment of the T20I series loss.
Yeah, I think Bangladesh will be very happy to see the series win, not just with the result, but the captain Nazmul Hussain Santu. I think this was great for his leadership playing against Sri Lanka, who were one of the best in subcontinent, and he got the runs as well. He got his leadership tested as well. So I think overall, the series win will have a great impact in Bangladesh's future as well. And Santu would be, I think he'd be leading the team for a long time now.
John, the test series to follow has seen Wanindu Hasaranga come out of test retirement to play, which means he'll miss the first three matches of his IPL season with Sunrisers Hyderabad. What do you make of that decision?
Well, on the face of it, it's all very peculiar. I think a natural first reaction by anybody would be you would have thought somebody would have worked that out. However, when you dig deeper, it's pretty clever as somebody has worked it out. It seems that shortly after his announcement, the ICC announced that he'd been banned from the two tests because he'd received 8 demerit points in 24 months for dissent. This means that he would miss either two tests or 4 ODIs or 4 T20Is, whatever comes first. Had he not come out of test retirement, it would have led to him missing the first 4 matches of Sri Lanka's T20 World Cup campaign. which would have been a blow for the side. And it also, quite incredibly, means that it's available for the start of the IPL. And I find that really quite peculiar.
Well, some ingenuity there to get round the regulations by
Really.
Hasaranga, it would seem. But, well, the first of the two tests without Hasaranga, even though he's come out of retirement, begins in Sylhet on March the 22nd, and we'll chat about it on the next episode here at The Wicket. Afghanistan gained a measure of revenge for their test defeat at the hands of Ireland by winning both white ball series between the two sides in Sharjah in the UAE. We featured the one-day internationals in our last episode, with Afghanistan winning that three-match series 2-0 with one game washed out due to torrential rain across the UAE. In the T20I series, Ireland won the first match by 38 runs, defending 149 for six, with Harry Tector producing a brilliant half century before leg spinner Ben White took 4 for 20. In game two, Afghanistan won by 10 runs, defending 152. Mohammad Nabi's 59 after his side were 14 for 4 was vital, as was Rashid Khan's 4 for 14. Then in the series decider, Ibrahim Zadran's 72 helped Afghanistan reach 155 for 7, and that proved to be more than enough as Ireland subsided to 98 in the face of brilliant seam and swing bowling from Ismatullah Omarzai with 4 for 9 and also Naveen Ul Haq, who took 3 for 10. John, with the T20 World Cup on the horizon, the two sides took very differing approaches. Ireland seemed set already on the core of their side for that World Cup, while Afghanistan experimented, mixing up their batting order and blooding young players like Nangiala Karote, the teenage left-arm spinner. Which approach do you think had and has more merit?
Well, on the face of it, Afghanistan's, I think there's a bit more than meets the eye. Looks like the two sides have managed to work up a fairly tense rivalry. So Afghanistan took Ireland very seriously, and they were seemingly aided by some contentious umpiring. Ireland, for their part, adopted an aggressive batting approach, which didn't work, maybe by way of experiment. It was also the manner of winning the toss and batting, Ireland doing that in the first match and Afghanistan doing it in the last two. I mean, the toss had a fairly major influence on the outcome of the series.
Sebash, Rashid Khan came back from the back injury that ruled him out for 4 months, and he barely missed a beat with a scarcely believable 8 for 45 from the 12 overs that he bowled. That's surely great news for Afghanistan, isn't it? And his IPL franchise, the Gujarat Titans.
Absolutely. I think that with World Cup coming near, Afghanistan would be a bit concentrated on how he fares out with Gujarat, how much workload does he need to manage. But I think Titans should be smiling with Hardik Pandya gone. They need someone to lead the attack with the spin, as well as the leadership that we've spoken about of high. So I think that Rashid Khan's inclusion and him performing so well, like he's never been apart from the game, I think that gives a huge boost to Gujarat Titans and even Afghanistan. I think we saw without Rashid Khan how weak the spin department is going to be. So I think Rashid will be a huge key in Afghanistan's World Cup campaign as well.
John, Ireland insisted on using Lorcan Tucker at number three throughout the T20I series, but his returns were very modest, 4, 10 and a first ball naught. Is there an argument for pushing Harry Tector up to three in this format on the basis you want your best players facing most deliveries?
No, it may be more of a psychological issue. Some players don't like batting at three. England had this issue with Joe Root. At four, as the best batter in the team, he felt that if the top three had done their jobs, he could then be more expansive and less exposed to the new ball with overall benefits to the team. Now, alternatively, you could argue that if your number three is out first ball, then the number four might as well be number three. I think for Ireland, they didn't get the best out of Tucker in the T20 series by batting him at three. I don't know what other alternatives they have.
Sebash, as John has touched upon already, there were some umpiring controversies in the series, and Ireland felt they were on the wrong end of some very poor decisions, with Andrew Balburnie fined 25% of his match fee for protesting at an LBW decision where he was given out sweeping, even though the ball came off his glove. There was no DRS in the series. Is it time to get DRS mandatory or neutral umpires involved in T20Is? as they are in other formats, or is that wrong, given that there is the need for home umpires to get the chance to stand in internationals, and at the moment, these are the only ones where two of them in each match get that chance?
Well, this is a prolonged debate. We had similar problems when we had the T20I series here in Nepal as well. But expecting DRS in all around the T20Is is not so practical, looking at the finances as well. You can't expect something like that in Nepal, where the finances is pretty low. But umpire, I think human error is possible. But when the umpire should seek for TV replays as much as possible. There could be mistakes, but I think as much as possible, it can be corrected when possible. So I think home umpires, I think that there should not be doubt upon the mode of dismissal, their decisions. Human error is possible, but I'd like to say the umpires should seek for technologist advice as much as possible.
Afghanistan now have eight players heading off to the Indian Premier League, while Ireland will have Josh Little, their left-arm fast bowler, who was excellent in the T20I series, doing likewise. The African Games are taking place in Accra in Ghana, and cricket is one of the sports involved. Eight teams are taking part in the cricket tournament, hosts Ghana, Kenya, Namibia, Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. This is a very significant event, as all the matches have official T20I status, and that's important because that means the results impact the ICC T20I team rankings. And that means a great deal because those rankings represent a path to direct qualification for the 2026 ICC Men's T20 World Cup in India and Sri Lanka. At the moment, there are 20 spots in that tournament. Eight go to the top eight sides in the upcoming event in the Caribbean and the USA. A further two go to India and Sri Lanka as co-hosts if they don't finish in the top eight this June and July. And then up to four spots go to teams on the basis of their positions in the ICC rankings. The cut-off for those rankings is June the 30th this year, 2024. And so a successful tournament in Accra could go a long way to ensuring those sides taking part don't then have to go through qualifying for 2026. However, most of the sides seem to have missed these details and have sent below strength sides to the tournament. South Africa even had 11 T20I debutants in their opening match against Ghana, and Zimbabwe had six in their first up win against Namibia, a match that saw Namibia have three debutants of their own. John, have the likes of Namibia and a couple of the other sides like Nigeria and even Zimbabwe, who failed to reach the upcoming T20 World Cup, missed a trick here and also put their chances of playing in the 2026 tournament at risk?
Possibly. My understanding is the ICC only approved the qualification process on March the 15th, and this would be after the squads were announced. Although you would think the respective boards would have been able to probably guess the process. I think South Africa might be looking over its shoulder, having lost to Kenya. Either way, it's good to see cricket being played in these games for the first time, and maybe that had some part to play in the way the squads were selected.
Sebash, the ICC made all T20 matches between members full 2020 internationals in 2018, but with South Africa choosing to play an understrength side and other teams also opting against sending senior players to Accra, doesn't this bring that decision into disrepute? It could well affect associate teams like Nepal in their attempts to reach the 2026 event.
Well, even till date, I'm surprised how the games are being looked after by the ICC. I think they said all the matches will be T20I, fair enough, but how the squads will be announced, how the boards will take these tournaments, like we have South Asian Games in Nepal as well, but you don't see India sending their weekend squad for that. Either they participate or they don't send the team at all. But this type of situations, I think this will help ICC to reevaluate their moves and maybe giving the T20 status to tournaments rather than the matches itself.
The teams in Accra have been divided into two groups, Uganda, South Africa, Kenya, and Ghana in Group A. and Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Namibia, and Nigeria in Group B. And as we record this podcast, the group stage is still going on. There's been plenty of drama already, with Nigeria beating Namibia with a six in the last over, the same over that saw an attempted run out at the non-striker's end by the bowler. The final is on March the 23rd and will wrap up the tournament and its implications for the ICC rankings and the T20 World Cup 2026 qualification next time. One more news line for you is that the ICC have decided that the overrate clock that's been trialled in white ball cricket since last December is to be mandatory in all ODIs and T20Is from June the 1st. The rule is that a fielding side must be ready to start a new over within a minute of the previous one finishing. A failure to achieve that will result in a warning, and three warnings will result in a five-run penalty, as will any subsequent failures. And finally, gentlemen, as we always do, let's hear from you about something that's caught your attention this week in the world of cricket. John, we'll start with you.
I'm going down under. Two things. What, first of all, was the announcement by Cricket Australia that Australia wouldn't be visiting Afghanistan? And secondly, Sheffield Shield final starting on March the 21st between Western Australia and Tasmania at Perth. Western Australia going for three in a row. Cameron Green and Mitch Marsh were released from that match. And now Cameron Bancroft, leading light for Western Australia, misses out having had a cycling accident. And on top of that, Matthew Wade has announced his retirement from red ball cricket after the final. Wade's worth a mention. He played 36 tests for Australia between 2012 and 2021. And his first-class career actually started way back in 2007. So he's been a valiant servant for both Tasmania and Australia.
Yes, I remember a couple of hundreds he got for Australia in the 2019 Ashes series, one of them in that pivotal first test match at Edgbaston, and one, albeit in a losing cause, at the Oval. A cricketer who made absolutely the most of his ability in the first class format, and in fact, averaging 40 in first class cricket, a very, very impressive cricketer indeed. Sebash, what about you? What's captured your attention over the past week?
Has to be Ellis Pery. I think she had a magical week last week, and RCB winning the title, that was so much special for their fans. The mainstream hadn't been able to do it, and it brought a whole new craze. And they were playing in Bengaluru. The crowd were fantastic. I think the women's game has elevated to the another standards in France's league now.
Well, thanks for joining us at The Wicket, and we'll be back soon with more cricket chat from the Gulf region, Asia, and worldwide. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment on what you've heard wherever you get your podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback and let us know if there's anything you'd like us to feature in future episodes. And also remember, we've recorded a separate podcast ahead of the Indian Premier League, the IPL. So please check your podcast feeds if you want to hear what we've had to say on each team's prospects in the biggest domestic T20 tournament in the world. For now, though, this is Brian Murgatroyd, along with John Pike and Sebash Hamagain, saying thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to your company again next time.